Bert is alive and the wedding will go ahead as scheduled at 4 o'clock. His tuxedo is hanging up in the closet, and in the breast pocket of the jacket are the rings, which Benji was going to hand over to Shooter, along with Shooter's best man gift, a pair of monogrammed cufflinks. He still has things to check off on his to-do list, such as setting up a boat trip and a spa day for Celeste once they get to Santorini, but now his procrastination doesn't matter. The wedding has been canceled. Of course the wedding has been canceled. There was no question of going forward with a wedding when Celeste's best friend was found dead. Benji is experiencing a host of very confusing emotions. He is upset, shocked, and horrified just like everyone else. And yet also mixed in there are anger and resentment. It's his wedding day. His parents have gone to enormous effort and expense to make this wedding unforgettable, and now it's all for naught. But aside from the predictable, shallow complaint that the happiest day of Benji's life has turned out to be tragic and chaotic, there is a deeper sadness that he won't be entering into a lifelong commitment with a woman he loves beyond all comprehension. He has been influenced enough by Celeste that he now occasionally thinks in wildlife metaphors. Celeste is like a rare butterfly that Benji was somehow able to capture. That comparison is, no doubt, inappropriate on many different levels, but that's how he thinks of her in his private mind, where no one can judge him. That she's like an exotic bird or butterfly. If he takes that imagery further, then marrying her is akin to putting her in a cage or pinning her to a board. She was supposed to be his. What Merritt's death has brought to light, however, is that Celeste belongs only to herself. She was the one who found Merritt. With Roger's help, Celeste pulled Merritt's body from the water. She was hysterical, beyond talking to, beyond consoling. She couldn't breathe, and Roger and the paramedics had wisely decided to take Celeste to the hospital where they could get her calmed down. Benji waited 2 hours before he went to see her in order to give her time and space to process what had happened. But when he arrived to pick her up, their conversation had not gone the way he expected it to. She had been in bed, woozy from the Valium, her eyelids fluttering open when he walked in the room. He sat at her bedside, took her hand and said, "I'm so sorry." She shook her head and said, "It's my fault." For reasons he could not explain, this answer had unleashed a mighty fury within him. He thought Celeste was blaming herself for having an oceanfront wedding, for asking Merritt to be her maid of honor, for bringing her here to Nantucket. And Benji's response to this came flying out. "She was lucky to be here. Lucky she had a friend like you. She didn't deserve you. Wasn't worthy of you, Celeste. And furthermore, she probably did this to herself. You told me once that she stockpiled pills and considered suicide, so what's to say that's not what this is? She orchestrated this to ruin our big day." Celeste had closed her eyes, and Benji thought the sedative had reclaimed her, but then she spoke.
"I can't believe you just said that. You blame Merritt. You think this is her fault, because you've never liked her. You thought she was a bad influence, but she was my friend, Benji. She was the friend I'd been looking for my entire life. She accepted me. She loved me. She took care of me. If I hadn't met Merritt when I did, I might have left New York. I might have gone back to Easton and worked at the zoo in Trexlertown. I might never have met you. You blame Merritt because you can't imagine a scenario where maybe someone in your house, someone in your family, made a very, very grave mistake. You think your family is beyond reproach, but you're wrong."
"What are you talking about?" Benji asked.
"You'll find out soon enough," Celeste said. "But right now, I'd like you to leave. I want to talk to the police, alone."
"What?" Benji said. "What about your parents? Do they even know? They were still in their room when I left."
"I've called my father," Celeste said. "Now please, go."
Benji had been incredulous, but he could see by the set of her jaw that she was serious. Benji stood to go, He knew there was no point broaching the topic of getting married in Greece or rescheduling the wedding for August. Merritt's death had changed things. He'd lost Celeste. Now he's left to pace Tag's study, asking the same question over and over again of his father and brother. What happened? Benji had gone to bed after they all got back from town last night, but Thomas and Tag stayed up. Right? Benji asks. Right? Right, Tag says. It was Thomas, myself, Merritt, and Featherly. What were you guys doing? Benji asks. Thomas shrugs. Drinking? Drinking what? Benji asks. Scotch? Rum, Tag says. I just wanted to finish my cigar. Enjoy the evening. I was sitting in peace with your brother until Merritt and Featherly joined us. Where did they come from? Benji asks. They'd clearly met at the party and hit it off, Tag says. They came out of the house chatting like soul sisters, like Thelma and Louise. Abby called me up to bed shortly after those two sat down with us, Thomas says. He holds up his palms. I literally have nothing to do with this. I barely knew Merritt, but she had that look. You know the look? She was trouble. Amen, Tag whispers. Did Merritt seem really drunk? Benji asks. Did it seem like she was on something? You need to relax, bro, Thomas says. The police will sort this out. The police, Benji thinks. That's why the three of them are holed up in his father's study. They're waiting to be questioned by the police. The study smells like tobacco and peat, and it's filled with antiques. Sextants, barometers, prints of long-ago British naval victories. Most men find Tag's study intriguing. Benji finds it obnoxious. Although, under the circumstances, it makes a serviceable bunker, and Benji could use a drink. Pour me a Glenmorangie? He asks his father. Before you talk to the police? Tag asks. Is that wise? Nantucket police! Intimidating bunch, Thomas says. I'll pour it. He heads over to the bar. If they suspected Benji, they would have questioned him first. Suspected me? Benji says. This isn't something that has crossed his mind. Why would they suspect me? At that moment, there's a knock on the study door, and Benji's heart somersaults in fear. Do the police suspect him? Tag strides across the room to open the door. His father looks respectable in a white polo shirt and a pair of dark Madras shorts, but Benji and Thomas are still in the gym shorts and t-shirts they slept in. It's Reverend Derby at the door. All three Winbury men exhale a sigh of relief. The Reverend embraces Tag. I came to see if I can help, the Reverend says. Benji can't handle any talk of God right now. He isn't in the mood to hear that this was part of God's plan, nor does he want to debate the question of whether it was a suicide and what that might mean for Merritt's soul. What's going on out there? Tag asks Reverend Derby. Is there any news? No one has said anything directly to me, the Reverend says, but I overheard someone saying that the medical examiner found a sedative in the young woman's bloodstream. She must have gone swimming for some reason and then just passed out. A sedative, Benji thinks. Bingo. Merritt took an Ambien and went into that well-documented twilight state where her brain was shutting down though her body was still awake. She went out for a late-night swim and she drowned. Reverend Derby claps Benji on the shoulder. How are you holding up, young man? Benji shrugs. He sees no point in lying to Reverend Derby. He is like part of the family, as close as an uncle. Most of Benji's memories of him are secular. Reverend Derby comes each year to the Winbury's anglicized Thanksgiving. He goes with Tag to Yankee games. He has spent many weekends here on Nantucket. He attended Thomas's and Benji's graduations from high school, college, grad school. Having Reverend Derby around always lent the family a certain moral authority, although none of the four Winburys is particularly religious. Or Benji isn't. He understands he can't speak for anyone else's interior life, but his life has been so blessed, up to this point, that he has had no need for religion. "I'm mostly concerned for Celeste," he says. "This has blindsided her." Reverend Derby looks at him with his watery blue eyes, but knows better than to speak. He lifts his hand from Benji's shoulder. "I'm going to give you your privacy. Just know I'm here if you need me." Tag shakes Reverend Derby's hand as he shows him the door. Thomas says, "Scotch." Benji and Thomas are each a drink and a half in when there's another knock at the door. Again, Tag stands to answer. Again, Benji's heart reacts like a pit bull straining on a chain. It's Benji's mother.
"May I come in?"
she asks Tag. Her voice is arch. Benji knows she doesn't like the way Tag guards the privacy of his study. It makes her suspicious, she says. Tag holds the door open and extends a hand. Greer walks in. She, too, is dressed appropriately, in a pair of white pants and a linen tank, the color of whole wheat bread. Her hair is up in a chignon, and she is wearing lipstick. Celeste would be offended, Benji suspects, that Greer saw fit to put on lipstick this morning. But Greer is a certain kind of British woman who wouldn't want the strangers in the house, the police, the forensics experts, the detective, to see her without makeup, no matter the circumstances. "Mom," he says. He believes in his mother's ability to somehow make this situation bearable.
"Oh, Benny," she says.
She uses his long-abandoned childhood nickname. It hits the right note. He knows she loves him. She squeezes him so tightly he can feel her bones and her beating heart. When she pulls away, she looks right at him, and he can feel her trying to shore him up. If anyone's hopes and dreams have been raised as much as his by the wedding going up in smoke, it's Greer's. And yet she seems to be processing the turn of events with mournful dignity, exactly as she should. "Have you talked to the Otises?" he asks. "Celeste said she called her father."
"They haven't emerged from their room," Greer says. "I had Elida deliver a tray with lunch, but I'm sure they're too upset to eat much."
She eyes the tumblers of scotch on the coffee table.
"Have you boys eaten anything?"
"No," Benji says.
"I could eat," Thomas says.
Greer looks at him sharply.
"Well, there are sandwiches in the kitchen."
"What's going on exactly?" Tag asks. "We're still waiting to speak to the detectives."
"I had my interview with a fellow from the state police," Greer says.
"I dare say he has it in for me."
"For you?" Benji says. Greer waves a hand.
"I'm not sure what they're thinking. The Nantucket chief just called to ask what inn Featherly is staying at."
"Featherly?" Thomas says. "What the hell does she have to do with anything?"
"Well," Tag says, "she was the last person to see Merritt."
"Was she?"
Greer asks.
"She was?" Thomas says.
Tag turns away from all of them and goes to pour his own scotch at the bar cart.
"I believe so," he says, looking into his glass before drinking. "Yes."
"Wasn't Featherly with you?"
Greer asks. She sounds more interested than accusatory.
"Didn't you take her out for a ride in the kayak?"
"Featherly?" Thomas says. "Why would Dad take Featherly out for a ride in the kayak? She's hardly the seafaring type."
"I didn't take Featherly out in the kayak," Tag says.
"You didn't?"
Greer says.
"I didn't," Tag says.
"You took someone out for a kayak," Greer says. "The kayak, the two-person kayak, was left overturned on the beach, with only one oar. And we all know nobody else used it."
Benji sinks into one of the leather club chairs and throws back what's left of his scotch. He doesn't like where this is headed. Here is his nuclear family, his parents and his older brother. They are the Winburys, a very fortunate group, not only because of their money, position, and advantages, but also because, By the standards of today, they are normal. A happy, normal family. A family, he would have said, without secrets or drama. But now he's not so sure. He speaks to the room. Who did you take out in the kayak, Dad? He thinks back to what Celeste said, that someone in his family had made a very, very grave mistake. Benji stands up. Dad? Tag is facing the bar cart. He has one hand on his glass and one hand wrapped around the neck of the Glenmorangie. Greer is watching him. Thomas is watching him. They're all waiting for an answer. His voice is barely a whisper, but his words and tone are clear. Merritt, he says. I took Merritt out in the kayak. Karen. Karen wakes up with a start. The sunlight is pouring through the windows, bright and lemony. She was supposed to be up at 8:30 to help Celeste get ready, but she can tell it's much later than that. She reaches over to check her phone. It's 12:30. Karen shrieks and sits up in bed. Bizarrely, there's no pain. No pain? Her last oxy was late last night, but still, that was 12 hours ago. On a normal day, her nerve endings are screaming after 7 or 8 hours. Bruce, she calls out. His side of the bed is empty, but she reaches out a hand, still warm. She hears him retching. He's in the bathroom. The blackberry mojitos and the scotch must have caught up with him. The toilet flushes, the water runs, and then Bruce comes into the bedroom. He looks smaller, she thinks, and 10 years older. He comes to sit next to her on the edge of the bed. Karen, he says, the wedding has been canceled. Canceled? She says. Somehow she already knew this, but how? She tries to piece together the events of the night before. Celeste had wanted to stay home, but Bruce and Karen had encouraged her to go out. They wanted her to enjoy herself. Celeste. Karen had had a bad dream. She was trying to find Celeste but couldn't get to her. And then came the revelation. Celeste didn't want to marry Benji. Karen had tiptoed down to Celeste's room. It had been empty. She had gone downstairs. She had overheard the strange, awful conversation between Bruce and Tag. Robin Swain. Karen shakes her head. Last night, the confession about Robin Swain had seemed so devastating, but this morning, her shock and horror have vanished, just like her pain. Human beings experience all kinds of crazy and unexpected emotions while they are alive. Robin Swain was nothing more than a tiny blip on the screen of their distant past. Celeste doesn't want to marry Benji, Karen says.
No, Karen, Bruce says. That's not it.
But that is it, Karen thinks. She has never once said this, but she does believe she is naturally closer and more in tune with Celeste than Bruce is. Celeste is Bruce's little girl, no doubt about that, but he doesn't understand Celeste's mind like Karen does.
Merritt died, Karen, Bruce says. Celeste's friend Merritt, the maid of honor. She died last night.
Karen feels like her head is going to topple right off her neck and onto the floor. What? She says.
They found her floating in the harbor this morning, Bruce says. She drowned.
She drowned? Karen says. She drowned last night?
Apparently so, Bruce says. I was with Tag and then I came to bed. You were asleep when I came in. That was pretty late, but it must have happened afterward.
Oh, no, Karen says. She is aghast, really and truly aghast. Merritt was so young, so beautiful and confident. How? What?
She drank or took drugs, I guess, Bruce says. And then she went swimming. I mean, What other explanation is there?
Where's Celeste? Karen asks.
The paramedics took her to the hospital, Bruce says. His eyes fill with tears. Celeste was the one who found her.
No. No, no, no. Their poor, sweet daughter.
Karen fears Celeste doesn't have the strength to deal with this. She is too fragile, too gentle and kind. This had been true even in adolescence, especially in adolescence. Other people's daughters had been drinking and smoking, secretly going on the pill or being fitted for diaphragms. Celeste had stayed home with Bruce and Karen watching Friday Night Lights. That had been their favorite show, so much so that Tim Riggins and Tammy Taylor felt like friends of the family, and often, Bruce, Karen, and Celeste would look at one another over their morning cereal and say, "Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose." Celeste volunteered at the Lehigh Valley Zoo in Trexlertown on the weekends. Bruce would drop her off, and Karen would pick her up. Karen would nearly always find Celeste with the lemurs or the otters, either feeding them or scolding them like naughty children. Karen used to have to yank her out of there. On Saturday nights, they would go to Diner 248 and then to the movies. Celeste would often see kids from school in groups or on dates, and she would wave and smile, but she never seemed embarrassed to be seen with her parents. She was always even-keeled and content, as though she simply preferred to be with Bruce and Karen, Mac and Betty.
"And so now the wedding has been canceled," Karen says.
"Yes," Bruce says, "and the police are conducting an investigation."
"Does the girl have family?" Karen asks.
"Not much, I guess," Bruce says. "She hasn't spoken to her parents in 7 years.
7 years? Karen thinks.
She's nearly as upset about that as she is about Merritt's passing. And yet, Karen could tell from the girl's demeanor that no one had been looking out for her, not even from afar. So now there will be no wedding. Karen understood this last night, but she had thought the reason would be different. She thought Celeste would call it off. And then Karen's visit to the psychic comes flooding back in vivid detail. The psychic studio was in downtown Easton, half a block from the Crayola factory. Karen used to pass it all the time on her way to and from work. She had looked at the sign with only mild curiosity. Catherine Randall, psychic, intuitive readings, angel whisperer. Catherine Randall was such a pretty name, such a normal Field of Daisies name. This had been part of what triggered Karen's interest. Her name wasn't Veda or Crystal or Starshower. It was Catherine Randall. Karen visited Catherine Randall 2 days after she received news of her metastases. She wasn't looking for Catherine to predict her future. She would live for weeks, months, a year, and then she would die. But she had to know what life held for Celeste. Catherine's studio was just a normal living room. Karen sat on a gray tweed sofa and stared at Catherine's diploma from the University of Wisconsin. She handed Catherine a photograph of Celeste and said,
"I need to know if you have any intuitive thoughts about my daughter."
Catherine Randall was in her mid-30s, as pretty as her name, with long, light brown hair, flawless skin, a calming smile. She looked like a kindergarten teacher. Catherine had studied the photograph for a long time, long enough for Karen to grow uncomfortable. She was thrown by the conventional surroundings. She had expected silk curtains, candles, maybe even a crystal ball, something that suggested a connection to the supernatural world. Catherine Randall closed her eyes, and she started to talk in a slow, hypnotic voice. Celeste was an old soul, she said. She had been to the earth before, more than once, which accounted for her serenity. She didn't ever feel the need to impress. She was comfortable with who she was. Catherine stopped suddenly and opened her eyes. "Does that sound right?"
"It does," Karen said, growing excited. "It really does."
Catherine nodded.
"She'll be happy.
Eventually,
Eventually, Karen said. A concerned look passed across Catherine's face, like a breeze rippling the surface of a pond.
Her romantic life, Catherine said.
Yes, Karen said.
I see chaos.
Chaos, Karen said. Here she had thought Celeste's love life was rock solid. She was engaged to Benjamin Winbury. It was a real-life fairy tale. Catherine offered a weak smile.
You were right to come to me, she said. But there's nothing either one of us can do about it.
Catherine had paid the $30 fee and left. Chaos.
Chaos?
After that, Karen had avoided walking by Catherine Randall's studio. She started parking in the lot on Ferry Street, even though it was farther away. Now, Karen's mind starts to grind. Catherine Randall was correct about chaos. The wedding has been canceled. Merritt is dead. She drank or took pills, Bruce said. Then drowned.
Pills, Karen thinks,
and she suddenly feels as nauseated as she did after her first round of chemo. Karen had caught Merritt coming out of this very bedroom last night. Merritt had said she was looking for Celeste, but that sounded like a fabrication. She hadn't been looking for Celeste. She had been looking for pills. Had she gotten as far as the third drawer in the bathroom? Had she found the bottle of oxy and the three pearlescent ovoids mixed in? Had she been curious about those pills and taken one to see what happened? The notion is too appalling for tears. It is a dense, dark, soul-destroying thought. Not only is Merritt dead, but it's Karen's fault. She needs to check her pills. She can't check her pills. If she checks her pills and finds one or more of the pearlescent ovoids missing, what will she tell Bruce? Celeste? The police? Her thoughts are a soundless scream. She can't continue another second not knowing. Karen gets to her feet. Her pain is still at bay, which is impossible, she knows. She hasn't taken an oxy in nearly 12 hours, so something else is at work in her body. The shock. Bruce falls back on the bed, his eyes open. He is there but not there, which is just as well. Karen closes the bathroom door, locks it. She sits on the toilet and slides open the third drawer. She takes out the bottle of pills. She clutches the bottle in her fist. Then she lays out a clean white washcloth and empties all of the pills onto it. She stares at the pile, smooths them out. One, two, three pearlescent ovoids, present and accounted for. And then, for good measure, she counts the oxy. All there. The rush of relief Karen feels nearly knocks her unconscious. She sways. Splotches appear in her vision. Karen staggers back to lie down on the white bed. The shape of her body is still imprinted in the sheets and blankets, like a snow angel. She fits herself back in like a piece of a puzzle and closes her eyes. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 2:47 p.m. The chief. He's prepared to give Valerie Gluckstern 1 hour with Shooter Uxley, but after only 20 minutes, she tells the chief that her client is ready to answer questions. In the interview room, the chief sits down across the table from Shooter and Val. The chief feels infinitely better since eating his lunch, but he needs to come up with something here because Barney from forensics called to say they found nothing in the shot glasses, on the cigar, or in the bottle of rum.
Are you sure? The chief asked. There has to be something in one of the glasses.
And Barney, who did not like having his expertise questioned, had sworn at the chief and hung up.
My thinking has changed substantially from this morning, the chief says.
He knows Nick likes to ease into things, build a rapport, and allow information to flow organically. But the chief isn't feeling it. A girl is dead. This guy made a run for it, and the chief wants answers, now.
Mr. Uxley is prepared to answer all your questions, as I said, Val says. He has nothing to hide.
The chief stares at the kid. He's too damn good-looking to pity, although he seems pretty shaken up.
Tell me where you were coming from this morning, the chief says.
Shooter spreads his fingers out on the table in front of him and stares at them as he speaks.
The steamship,
he says.
What were you doing at the steamship? The chief asks.
I was trying to leave the island, Shooter says.
But you missed the boat, the chief says.
I didn't miss the boat, Shooter says. I just changed my mind.
You changed your mind, the chief says. You better start explaining yourself, son.
The chief looks at Val.
Your client lied about being at the Walwinet. He lied about his alibi. Then he tried to board the Highline with a stolen ticket. Now I'm hearing that he was at the steamship this morning to board the 6:30 boat, presumably without anyone's knowledge, since the groom told Sergeant Dixon he was missing. The ME put the time of death on the girl between 2:45 and 3:45. She was dead, and then he decided to flee. On the basis of these facts alone, I have probable cause to hold you for murder one.
You do not, Val says. The chief turns to Shooter.
You'd better cough up one hell of a believable story.
Shooter taps his fingers one by one, starting with his left pinky, proceeding all the way to his right pinky, and then going back again. Val puts a hand on his forearm.
Tell the chief what you told me, she says.
It's okay.
I left the Winbury compound early this morning, Shooter says. I walked all the way to the Rotary and caught a cab down to the steamship. I was going to the steamship because...
He hesitates, looks at Val.
She nods. Because I was running away with the bride.
Running away with the bride, the chief thinks. This was one hell of a wedding.
I'm in love with Celeste, and she said she was in love with me, Shooter says. Last night, a bunch of us went out after the party, and Celeste and I peeled off to get some pizza, and I asked her to run away with me.
He pauses, looks down at the table, takes a deep, shaky breath, then continues.
I told her that I would take care of her, that I would love her forever. All she had to do was meet me at the steamship at 6 o'clock this morning. We were going to hop on the 6:30 slow boat to Hyannis, rent a car, drive to Boston, fly to Las Vegas, and get married ourselves.
Val says, Mr. Uxley waited at the steamship for Miss Otis until 6:35. She turns to Shooter. Is that accurate?
When I saw the ferry pulling out, when I heard the foghorn, I knew she wasn't coming. Shooter says, I had figured there was a 50-50 chance she'd be there. When she didn't show, I thought she decided to marry Benji. So I took a taxi back to the house, because I was the best man, and there was going to be a wedding after all. That's when I saw you, the chief asks. And you told me Merritt was dead.
He shakes his head.
You know, Celeste was afraid to follow through with our plan because she thought something bad would happen if we did it.
He swallows.
I'm sure she's blaming herself. Why didn't you tell me this in the first place? The chief asks. Instead of coming clean, you lied to me. Then you ran off. You understand the light that puts you in? Why should I believe a word you say?
I was rattled, Shooter says. I thought I was coming back to a wedding, and instead... You tell me that Merritt is dead?
I couldn't add our drama on top of that. Celeste would have had to corroborate my story, and I wanted to protect her from that. And I didn't want the Winburys to know. I was agitated and confused, and I figured it would be easier to just say I'd been with Gina. I didn't think you'd actually check it out. Then, once I knew I'd been caught in a lie, I figured my only course of action was to bolt.
Shooter looks at the chief.
I realize I handled this poorly, but I didn't kill Merritt. Did Merritt know the two of you were running away? The chief asks. Do you think Celeste confided in her?
We agreed not to tell anyone, Shooter says. We were going to make a clean break for it, get off the island, then tell everyone later. Celeste wasn't even going to say anything to her parents. So no, I do not think she confided in Merritt.
The interview room is quiet for a second. The chief is combing back through the story. Does it make sense? Does it have any holes? Nick is a strong believer in intuition when it comes to questioning. The story may make sense, but do you believe the guy?
Yes, the chief thinks.
He recalls Roger saying that when Celeste found the body, she had a bag packed. She was headed to meet Shooter and she...
What?
Caught a glimpse of something in the water as she was leaving? It wasn't impossible. She had a bag packed. For that reason, and that reason alone, the chief is going to choose to believe Mr. Uxley. He stands up and nods at Val.
You two are free to go, he says.
He has to move on, and quickly, to tag Winbury and the Dale woman, whoever she is. August 2017. Celeste. Her mother's cancer has metastasized to her bones. There are tumors on her spine. The cancer isn't curable. They can, however, do another course of chemo, which will buy her a year to 18 months. Benji's response to the news is to pull Celeste closer and hold her tighter. They are now engaged, and this has inspired him to become the spokesperson for We. He wants Karen to get a second opinion at Mount Sinai. His parents know influential people who sit on the board of directors. They'll be able to get Karen an appointment with the best doctors, the very best doctors. Celeste resents Benji's involvement. She and her parents are an insular unit. Mac, Betty, and Bug. They are the We. It feels like Benji is horning in with his connections and his optimism. In Benji's world, every problem has a solution, thanks to who the Winburys know and how much money they have. Celeste says,
My parents can't afford to get a second opinion at Mount Sinai. My father's insurance was maxed out long ago.
I'll pay for it, Benji says.
I don't want you to pay for it, Celeste says. My mother has a doctor she likes and trusts. Dr. Edmund at St. Luke's, which is a real hospital, by the way, not just some clinic in a strip mall.
Okay, I get it, Benji says, though Celeste knows exactly what he's thinking. He's thinking that St. Luke's isn't as good as Mount Sinai. How could it possibly be as good when it isn't in New York City, and Tag and Greer don't know anyone who sits on the board? I'm only trying to help.
Thank you. Celeste says as sincerely as she can. I'm very upset, and I want to handle this my own way.
Because Celeste is just back from her Nantucket vacation, she can't take any more time off. It's the end of summer, and the zoo is simply too busy. But in the middle of her first week back, Celeste rents a zip car and drives out to see her parents after work. When Celeste reaches the house on Durhammer Street, she finds her mother sitting at the kitchen table with a coloring book for adults and a deluxe set of 64 pencils. Celeste walks in, and she holds up the page she's been working on. It's a mandala.
Not bad, huh? Karen says.
She has colored the mandala in shades of green, blue, and purple.
Pretty, Celeste says, but her voice is shaky and her eyes well up.
Karen has worked at the Crayola Factory gift shop for over a decade. Some people sniff at what they see as a menial job selling boxes of crayons, but Karen has always taken pride in it.
I bring color into children's lives, she says.
Karen stands up and lets Celeste hug her.
I'm going to win this battle, she says.
You're not supposed to call it a battle, Celeste says. I read that somewhere. It's a violent word, and some survivors find it offensive.
Karen scoffs. Offensive? She says. So what am I supposed to call it?
A journey, Celeste says.
Bullshit, Karen says. Celeste blinks in surprise. Her mother never swears. It's a battle. They go for a quick dinner at Diner 248 and make a point of ordering the fudgy wudgy, though Celeste and Bruce manage only one bite apiece, and Karen doesn't have any. Karen makes a big fuss over Celeste's diamond ring. It's the most beautiful ring she has ever laid eyes on. It's the biggest diamond she has ever seen, a full 4 carats, and set in platinum. Celeste says,
I'm thinking of postponing the wedding. I'm thinking of quitting my job and moving home until you get better.
Nonsense, Karen says. Her voice is sharp and loud, and people at nearby tables turn their heads. The three Otises sit in silence for a second. They aren't people who draw attention to themselves. Celeste knows better than to say anything further. Her mother has spent Celeste's entire life claiming that no mortal man would ever be good enough for Celeste, but that's because she didn't have the imagination to dream up someone like Benjamin Winbury, a real-life Prince Charming. Celeste's future will be blessed. She will never have to worry about money the way that Bruce and Karen did. Celeste looks at Mac and Betty sitting across from her in the booth the way they always do, her father's arm draped across her mother's shoulders, her mother's hand resting on her father's thigh. Celeste envies them. She doesn't want money. She wants what they have. She wants love. In case you have any doubts. If anything, Karen says in a lower voice, I was thinking you might get married sooner. Maybe in the spring or early summer.
I'm in love with you.
Sooner? Celeste thinks. She nods. Okay, she whispers. Shooter has disappeared back into his own life. Steakhouses, downtown clubs, the U.S. Open with clients, Vegas with clients to draft fantasy football teams. Benji shows Celeste the pictures, but she barely gives them a glance. She can't think about Shooter. She can't not think about Shooter. Part of her suspects her desire for Shooter is what caused Karen's cancer to spread. Celeste knows life doesn't work like that, but she still gets the nagging sense that the two things are connected. If she stays with Benji, if she marries Benji, Karen will get better. If they get married in the spring or early summer, Karen will live forever. Celeste drops 5 pounds, then 10. Merritt expresses envy and tells Celeste how wonderful she looks. Celeste is irritable at work. She finally loses her temper with Blair, the hypochondriac. One more missed day and Blair will be fired, Celeste says. Blair threatens a lawsuit. She has legitimate reasons for calling in sick. Celeste, in a rare fit of rage, tells Blair she needs to stop with the bullshit. And the next thing Celeste knows, she's getting called into Zed's office for a lecture on professional attitude, appropriate workplace language, blah, blah, blah. Greer summons Benji and Celeste to the Winbury apartment for dinner. She has made something called a cassoulet. Celeste is her dutiful self and replies that it sounds good, but in fact, Celeste is annoyed. She has no idea what cassoulet is. She hates constantly being confronted with these erudite dishes. Can't Greer just make meatloaf or sloppy joes like Betty? And it turns out that cassoulet has duck, pork skin, and worst of all, beans in it. Celeste manages 2 bites. Her lack of appetite goes largely unnoticed, however, because Greer's real motivation isn't to feed Celeste and Benji, but rather to let them know that she would like to plan their wedding. They can have the entire thing at Summerland on Nantucket the weekend after the 4th of July. Benji reaches for Celeste's hand under the table. Would that be okay with you? He asks.
We don't want you to feel railroaded, Tag says. My wife can be a bit forceful.
I'm just trying to help, Greer says. I want to offer my support and our resources. I hate to think of you having to plan a wedding while your mother is so sick.
Celeste nods like a marionette.
Sounds good, she says.
At first, Celeste stutters only when she's talking about the wedding. She has a problem with the word caterer. It's a stuttery word all by itself. Then reverend, then church. People pretend not to notice, but the stutter grows gradually worse. Benji finally asks about it, and Celeste bursts into tears. She can't control it, she says. Soon, all hard consonants give her trouble. But not at work. Not on the phone with Merritt. Not alone in her apartment when she's reading in bed. She can read entire passages from her book aloud and not trip up once. Celeste holds out hope that a big, elaborate wedding on Nantucket will prove to be a logistical impossibility. It's too last minute. Every venue must already be booked. And so either the wedding will be postponed indefinitely, or they can plan something smaller in Easton, something more like her parents' wedding, a ceremony at the courthouse, a reception at the diner. But apparently, Greer's influence and her pocketbook are mighty enough to make miracles happen. Greer enlists Shaban at Island Fair, arranges for Reverend Derby to do the service at St. Paul's Episcopal, finds a band and an orchestra, and hires Roger Pelton, Nantucket's premier wedding coordinator. Not that Greer can't handle it all herself, but she does have a novel to write, and it would be silly to have a resource like Roger on the island and not use him. The wedding is set for July 7th. Greer asks Celeste what she would like to do about bridesmaids.
Oh, Celeste says.
This obviously isn't something she can ask Greer to handle.
I'll have my friend Merritt Monaco.
Merritt will be a good maid of honor. She knows all the rules and traditions, although Celeste shudders when she thinks about the bachelorette party Merritt might plan. Celeste will have to talk to her about that. She notices Greer is still looking at her expectantly.
And who else? Greer asks.
Who else? Her mother? Nobody ever asks her mother to be a bridesmaid. Celeste knows that much. She doesn't have a sister or any cousins. There are no suitable choices at work. Blair is now not speaking to Celeste. Bethany is her assistant, so that's too weird. And the rest of the staff are men. There is Celeste's roommate from college, Julia, but Celeste's relationship with Julia was utilitarian rather than friendly. They were both scientists, both neat and respectful, but they parted ways after college. There is Celeste's one social friend from college, Violet Sonata, but Violet took a job at the Ueno Zoo in Tokyo. Is there anyone from high school? Cynthia from down the street had been Celeste's closest friend, but she dropped out of Penn State with a nervous condition, and Celeste hasn't talked to her since. Merritt has a bunch of people she knows in the city, but Celeste can barely remember who is who. She is a social misfit, and now Greer will know it.
Let me think about it, Celeste says, hoping Greer will assume there are too many young women to choose from, and Celeste will need to whittle the list down.
But Greer, of course, sees the humiliating truth. It's because she's a novelist, Celeste supposes. She is perceptive to a fault. It's almost as if she reads minds.
I shouldn't get involved, Greer says, but I do think Abby would love to serve as a bridesmaid.
Celeste perks up immediately. Abby. She can ask Abby Winbury, Thomas's wife. She's the right age. She is appropriately girly. She has probably been a bridesmaid 20 times before. Celeste relaxes even as she realizes that the Winburys are providing for her once again. Celeste tells Benji that she's asking Merritt to be her maid of honor and Abby to be her bridesmaid, and Benji gets a crease in his brow. Abby? He says. Are you sure? The nice thing is that Celeste doesn't have to hide anything from Benji.
I couldn't think of anyone else, she says. You're marrying the most socially awkward girl in New York.
Benji kisses her, and I couldn't be happier about it.
So what's wrong with Abby?
Celeste asks.
Nothing, Benji says. Did she say yes?
I was planning on emailing tomorrow from work,
Celeste says. Benji nods.
What?
Celeste says. Abby would be filling a glaring gap. And besides, as Thomas's wife, wouldn't Abby be insulted not to be asked? It's true, Abby can sometimes be a bit off-putting. She was a sorority girl at the University of Texas, and she has retained some shallow cattiness, and she is presently obsessed with getting pregnant. But she is family.
I get the feeling Thomas and Abby are on the rocks, Benji says.
Celeste gasps.
What?
Thomas is always taking trips alone, Benji says, and going out with his friends after work, not to mention his obsession with the gym.
Oh, Celeste says. She knows Benji is right. They have met Thomas and Abby for dinner a few times, and Thomas is always the last to arrive, often straight from the gym, still in his sweaty workout clothes. Abby won't even let him kiss her unless he's showered, she says. He has to shower before sex, and sex is kept to a schedule since they are trying to conceive. But why try so hard for a baby if you're not planning on staying together?
I'm not asking Thomas to be my best man, Benji says.
What?
Celeste says. This shocks her even more than the news of Thomas and Abby's supposed marital discord.
But he's your brother.
Something is going on with him, Benji says, and I want to distance myself from it. I'm having Shooter serve as my best man.
Shooter?
Celeste says.
I've already asked him, Benji says. He was so happy, he teared up.
He teared up, Celeste thinks. So happy.
What are you going to tell Thomas?
I'll tell Thomas he can be an usher, Benji says. Maybe.
Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 3:30 p.m. Greer. At 3:30, when all of the guests have been called and all of the friends and relatives back in England have been notified about the tragedy and all of the wedding preparations have been summarily undone, except for those that are part of the crime scene, Greer takes a moment to peek out the window at the second cottage, the one where Merritt was staying. It's wrapped in police tape like a tawdry present, although the forensics men have left, and no one is there to stop Greer from entering. She would love to go in and poke around, but she fears the Winburys are in enough trouble as it is. She can't afford to cause any more. Tag took Merritt out in the kayak. Merritt, not Featherly. Greer needs to speak to Tag alone, but he said he had to make a phone call, probably to Sergio Ramon, who is not only a friend, but a brilliant criminal defense attorney. Greer isn't sure even Sergio can get Tag out of this mess. He took the girl out on the kayak, and she shows up in the morning dead, drowned in the harbor. Greer retreats to the master suite and perches on the sofa at the end of the bed, waiting for Tag, although she expects him to be led from the house in handcuffs the instant the police figure out this affair was going on. The boys handled the news badly. Benji exploded.
Did you kill her, Dad? Did you kill her?
No, Tag said. I took her out on the kayak, yes, I did. But I brought her back to shore safely.
He sounded like he was telling the truth. His inflection and tone were full of calm conviction, but Greer now knows he's been lying to her for a long time, maybe for the entirety of their marriage, so how would she know for sure? Thomas hadn't said anything at all. Possibly he, like Greer, had been too stunned to speak. The ring that Greer thought Tag had bought for Featherly, he'd bought for Merritt. Greer had seen the ring on Merritt's thumb. She had seen it. But she had one thing so firmly lodged in her brain that there hadn't been room for any other possibilities. The ring had been Tag's only misstep.
Greer had gone in to see Jessica Hicks, the jeweler, about wedding bands. Greer thought it would be a nice touch for Benji and Celeste to have rings fashioned by a Nantucket jeweler. The instant Greer entered the shop, Jessica's brows had shot up. She said, "Did your daughter-in-law not like the ring then?" "Daughter-in-law?" Greer had said. "The one who's pregnant?" Jessica said. "Did she not like the ring?"
"The ring?" Greer had said.
"Your husband came in," Jessica said. "Oh, right," Greer had said enthusiastically, although a bad feeling had started to seep through her. Tag had said nothing about getting a present for Abby, and Tag wasn't known for thoughtful gestures where the kids were concerned. He left that to Greer.
"He told me about it, but we've been so busy, he hasn't had a chance to show it to me," Greer said. "And he wouldn't do a proper job describing it anyway."
"What did it look like?"
"Silver lace pattern," Jessica said, "embedded with multicolored sapphires, like this one. It's meant to be worn on the thumb."
Jessica had then shown Greer a ring that sold for $600. So it wasn't a fortune, wasn't like a trip to Harry Winston for diamonds, but Greer had been near certain she would never see Abby wearing that ring. Tag steps into the bedroom, closes the door behind him, and locks it.
"Greer," he says.
He holds his hands up as if she might strike him. She would like to strike him. What has he done? The girl dead, the wedding canceled, their marriage, their life? And yet all Greer can think to say is,
"I thought you were having an affair with Featherly."
Tag's eyes widen. "No," he says.
"No,"
Greer says.
"It was Merritt."
"Yes," he says.
Greer nods. "If you want me to help you, you had better tell me everything. Everything, Tag." "It started the night of the wine dinner," he says. "They were both drunk, very drunk, and she came on to him. They slept together. It was unremarkable, regrettable. He thought that would be it, but then he bumped into her again in the city, by accident, at a hotel bar, and she invited him to her apartment. He's not sure why, but he said yes. And then there was another time or two, but he finally demanded she leave him alone."
"You bought her gifts?" Greer says.
"No."
"Tag,"
he sighs,
"a trinket.
It was her birthday a few weeks ago. That was when I ended it. She wanted to go away together. I said no. She persisted. I booked a room at the Four Seasons downtown."
The Four Seasons? Every detail pierces her.
"She was late showing up, and in the minutes that I was waiting, I came to my senses. I left the hotel and went home to you."
"So how many times did you screw her?" Greer asks. "Some total."
"More than 5. Less than 10, Tag says.
Greer feels ill. She can see the allure, she supposes. Merritt was attractive. She was young, free, unfettered. Merritt had the whiff of a rebel about her. Who wouldn't want to shag Merritt? What makes Greer want to vomit on her shoes is the thought of her own self while all of this was going on those 6, 7, 8 times. What had Greer been doing? Was she writing her perfectly mediocre novel, or was she planning their son's wedding? Whatever she was doing, she wasn't paying attention to Tag. She hadn't given Tag a minute's thought.
"And that was it?" Greer says. "Nothing more? You had an affair, you broke it off? She was upset about it? I saw her crying during the rehearsal dinner, in the laundry room of all places."
"So when you talk to the police, you'll tell them she was emotionally overwrought and that she threatened suicide if you didn't leave me. You took her out on the kayak to try and talk some sense into her. You delivered her back to shore. You came to bed. She drowned herself."
"Well," Tag says.
"Well, what?"
"It's a bit stickier than that," Tag says. He clears his throat. "She was pregnant."
Greer closes her eyes. "Pregnant."
"You're going to the gallows," she says.
Tag's face crumples. Greer has landed.